Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Imagine, there are two hot basketball teams in the same town, among the best in the nation. Their colleges are just across town from each other, so a showdown is a must. Except for one thing. One team is white, the other black. And in 1944 North Carolina, whites and blacks are forbidden to compete. What happens next says a lot about the nation we were and the nation we are. Scott Ellsworth has written a book about it, The Secret Game. Scott, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Brian, I'm thrilled to be here.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My dad was a geologist, a petroleum geologist, and my mom was a homemaker to three children.
And when you went off to high school or started high school, what would you say your core values were that you'd learned in that family?
I would say the core values were, I certainly grew up in church, in the Presbyterian church. I was an Eagle Scout, a Boy Scout. But I learned to be open to people from different backgrounds, different races, different social classes. My mom was a working class daughter of Norwegian immigrants, The first to graduate probably from grade school in her family, much less college.
Really?
My dad had been on General MacArthur's staff and was part of the occupation of Japan and got to know lots of Japanese, helped to reestablish the culture pearl industry in Japan.
Your dad did.
My dad did after the war. And so we had visitors from different countries that would come and see us. So I think it was to be patriotic. I think to, again, religious honor, but also that we should be open to people who don't look like us.
Where'd you go to college? What'd you study?
I went to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, and made a great mistake because one of my classmates was this guy named Steve who was very interested in computers.
Rings a vague bell.
Right,
but I didn't know he went to Reed.
Yes, that's right. And I didn't drop out and go live in his garage with him. So I ended up being an American history major. I wrote my bachelor's thesis on the worst racial incident of violence in American history, which was the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921 in my hometown. And I later wrote a book about that as well.
You know, I like to think I know something about American history. You just helped display my ignorance. Summarize the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921.
Well, a brief summary would be that in the course of about 24 hours, more than 1,000 homes and businesses owned by African Americans were burned by white mobs with the help of white police. A community was wiped out. We don't know how many people died, anywhere from 50 to 100. No whites were ever prosecuted for this event. It was an event that was actively suppressed. The memory of it was, as a kid, I heard stories about it. It piqued my interest. And then in graduate school at Duke University in North Carolina, I ended up doing some more work on it and found some old-timers who would talk about it and help put the together. I wrote the first comprehensive history of the riots. Been out. Book called Death in a Promised Land. It's been in print for 32 years.
To stay in print for 32
yeah.
years, I can say, as the son of an author, is a serious accomplishment. To write a book takes a commitment, a serious commitment. Mm-hmm. So where did that come from? You have a lot of choices to write books about different subjects. Why that race riot?
You know, I had grown up during the era of the civil rights movement, the era of desegregation. I was born in March of 1954, 2 months before the Brown decision, although it was not until I was in a freshman in high school that I had my first black classmate. My high school desegregated. We had a lot of racial violence, a lot of racial tension. And that sort of piqued my interest in the history of race relations in the United States. That's sort of how it began. And then I was encouraged along the way, both at Reed College and later at Duke, to continue my work and to write about it.
Now, you're white. What was the reaction of most of your white classmates to the racial tension?
When the riots broke out in my high school, the quote riots, and the troubles broke out in my high school, I was a member of the swim team, which was all white. And after 2 days of bloody fighting in the halls, our swim coach, also white, came down and sat down with us and said, "Boys, I don't want you to start any trouble, but I don't want you to back down if it comes. So it was a deeply divided school. And certainly people were, well, why do you want to write about this race riot? Why do you want to bring this up?
Right.
So, you know, and there had been people before me that had been threatened. I never ran into that. I was just kind of a young, long-haired 20-something-year-old that nobody really worried about too much.
Going back just for a second to Reed College, it's internationally renowned as sort of a laid-back, non-traditional educational model.
But it's not.
Tell us about
well,
it.
Well, it's very open in terms of student freedom, and you can do whatever you want to. But it's probably, and I'm an alum, but it's probably the most rigorous undergraduate education aside from the military academy. You have lots of requirements. You can be an art major. You have to take science classes. You can be a science major. You have to take humanities courses. So there's people study all the time. It seems like it's an anything-goes place, and maybe socially it is, but academically it's not.
I think you said you went to Duke Graduate School. What did you study?
I studied history, American history. I was in something called the Oral History Program, which was a pioneering program of African-American and white graduate students, many from the South, who were using oral history as a tool to recover particularly the history of the civil rights movement, but more broadly, the history of race relations in the United States.
And how was that experience for you?
It was tremendous. I mean, it was great. I mean, it was, people were very passionate about what they were studying, what they were looking into. And part of what was going on is a lot of our history, you really have to talk to people who were there. Many things aren't recorded. They're not in letters. They're not in documents. And oftentimes you have to go to old-timers and talk to them about what happened, what they saw. And being able to share those experiences together was very helpful.
Then what?
Well, after I graduated from Duke, I decided I didn't want to be a college professor, even though I'm sort of one now. I ended up at the Smithsonian Institution for 10 years at the National Museum of American History. And one thing I learned there was really key, which is that most Americans are really interested in our history. It just needs to be presented in an accessible way. And the types of books that most scholarly historians write are not the types of books that the average citizen is going to find a way into. So it got me thinking more about how to write stories, how to write about our past in a way that I can get a broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
And my book on Tulsa came out. I was looking for another subject, something I cared about, was passionate about, had some expertise. So I knew about race, but I was also a diehard college basketball fan. And I thought that there was a good book about basketball and race that hadn't been written yet, and that was something I was interested in doing.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Scott Ellsworth about his book, The Secret Game. You were saying?
I'll tell you a quick story, which is there's a saying in New York City publishing circles, certainly 20 years ago, less so today, about sports books. And the saying is, the smaller the ball, the better the book. And which means, of course, that there's a great literature of golf and baseball books are terrific and tennis books are good. But certainly 20 years ago, most football books and basketball books weren't very good. And I wanted to write something about, I knew there had been a big change in basketball between the 30s and the 60s. But I also wanted to write a book that would also reflect the fact that basketball is an American sport. It's one of our gifts to the world. And I thought that I could connect it more to the American experience. So I got this great idea. I was going to write on the 1957 Final Four, NCAA Championship Final Four, which had a still segregated all-white team from the University of North Carolina in a triple overtime championship game against the most storied program in college basketball, which is the University of Kansas, who had the first great African-American college star, Wilt Chamberlain.
I've heard the name.
You've heard the name. Plus, television is coming into the fore. The game is getting more popular. The civil rights movement has started. And so I went to work on this. I went all over the place, interviewed people from these four different teams, did a lot of research. And then, Brian, I made a horrible mistake, which is by that point I'd gotten married and moved back to North Carolina with my wife. And my horrible mistake was I decided to do 3 days of research at the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts. And the 3 days I was there coincided with one of their annual induction ceremonies. So I took a break at some point from the library, walked down, was watching things, and an elderly African-American man came up and approached me, and his name was John McClendon. We start to talk. The name seems kind of familiar. McClendon, Kansas. He didn't really play. He's important for some reason. We talk a little bit more, and then he mentions the fact that he had known James Naismith. Well, this is in 1996 or so. James Naismith had invented basketball in Springfield 105 years earlier.
Now, when you say invented basketball, you mean he invented
the game. James Naismith literally invented basketball. It was a weekend assignment for him. It was at a YMCA training college in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he had to come up with an indoor game to keep rowdy students entertained during the winter months. And so he did. And so, but as I talked to McClendon, I said, oh, right, you were at the University of Kansas in the late 30s. Naismith ended his career at Kansas.
Naismith, African-American or Anglo?
He's white, Canadian-American, who invented basketball. And I realized, oh, he had known him. And the more I started to talk to this charming John McClendon, this elderly ex-coach, African-American, I said, you know, I got to do a profile on you. So the next day I called the sports editor at the New York Times. And I said, I'd like to write a profile on John McClendon. And he said, who the hell is John McClendon? And so I explained that he's this coach and da-da-da. And so he's fine. So I flew to Cleveland, Ohio to interview John McClendon. And it was during the course of my interview that he started to tell me about the secret game.
Tell us about it.
Well, at the end of the interview, Coach McClendon comes with this 2 pages of type paper stapled together. And at the top it says, Racial First in Basketball I've Been Involved With by John McClendon. And it's an amazing list. He was the first black coach in the pros. He was the first African-American assistant Olympic coach for the U.S. basketball team. He was the first black coach back in the 1950s to win a non-segregated national basketball championship. He was the first black coach at a Division I white school, all of these things. But at the top of the list, it says 1944, first integrated college basketball game in the South between the North Carolina College for Negroes and a Duke University Medical School military team. And he's talking along, and I'm thinking to myself, this guy can't type, because it's not 1944. I mean, in 1944, that's 11 years before the Civil Rights Movement begins, 20 years before Selma. In fact, it's 3 years before Jackie Robinson desegregates baseball. Mm-hmm. So I said, excuse me, Coach, you mean 1954 or 1958 or something like that? And he says no. And it was at that exact moment that my book on the 1957 Final Four was torpedoed forever to sink beneath the waves, and a new adventure began with me writing this book about the secret game.
So here you are. You decide to write a book about something that took place 50 or so years ago. Other than Mr. McClendon.
Coach McClendon, yeah, John McClendon.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, I was lucky in that there were players alive on both teams. So I tracked them down. Jack Burgess, who was a Montanan, played varsity basketball at the University of Montana, was later in at Duke University in a hurry-up medical school program there during the war. Dave Hubbell and others who had also were on the team. So the members of the Duke team I was able to find. I was also able to find quite easily the still-living members of Coach McClendon's team as well. That was augmented with a lot of library research, other things, and talking to lots of people, black and white, who were alive in North Carolina in the late 30s and 1940s, as well as old coaches, John Wooden, other people like that I interviewed to try to put the game and put what else I've written about into perspective.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Scott Ellsworth about his book, The Secret Game. Now, someone might say, okay, blacks play whites for the first time in the South, 1944. What's the big deal?
Well, the big deal is that if you cross the color line in the South in 1944, you are going to go ahead and take your life into your own hands. The same year of the game, a black GI in uniform named Booker T. Spicely got onto a Durham City bus. He did not move all the way to the back of the bus, as African Americans were supposed to, got into an argument with the white bus driver who was armed. All bus drivers in North Carolina and Durham were armed at the time. The soldier said, "I thought I was fighting a war for democracy. Why can't I sit anywhere I'd like to?" The argument continues. The bus gets to the end of the line. The soldier walks off the bus. The bus driver walks off the bus, unholsters his 45, and murders the soldier right there. Everybody saw what happened. The soldier hadn't threatened the bus driver, anything like that. 2 months later, a trial occurs. An all-white jury, after 10 minutes of deliberation, acquit the white bus driver. So if you deliberately cross the color line in the South in those years, the consequences can be very serious. So that's the main reason the game is significant. But the book itself, you know, the book, The Wizard of Oz, really isn't about the Wizard of Oz. You know, it's really about the journey that Dorothy and everybody takes to get to the Emerald City and all that. The Secret Game is kind of the end point of my book. And the book itself is really about two larger subjects. One would be how basketball itself changed and became this exciting, you know, really on the way to becoming a first-class sport, one that Americans deeply love. The other story was I discovered that in the South during World War II, there were significant numbers of blacks and whites who've declared an undeclared war against segregation, and they're taking chances to push back against it.
In the South?
In the South. Those are the larger stories that the book is about.
Okay, let's take the two of them. I have played basketball, couldn't hit the backboard with a brick. was fair on defense, supposedly. You said the game changed radically between 1930 and 1960.
Mm-hmm.
In summary, who and why and how did it change?
Very quickly, there were some rule changes that made a big difference. There used to be something called the center jump until 1939, which meant that every time a team scored a field goal, play would stop, both teams would reassemble at the center of the court and reenact the tip-off after every single point.
Really?
So as a result, you had basketball scores that are, you know, 30 to 21 or, you know, whatever, very low-scoring game. That's one thing. Equipment got better as well, too. But when the center jump was eliminated, people started to experiment with a fast break. But John McClendon at North Carolina College for Negroes, his fast break was super revved up. He is, in effect, the father of modern basketball, and he is for three reasons. The first is, during World War II, the average college games were a team would score maybe 50 points a game. His North Carolina College Eagles were scoring 60, 70, 80, 90 points a game. He beat one team 119 to 26. He got his players to be able to move the ball from one end of the court to the next in 3 seconds or less, which was unheard of at the time. That was the first thing. He was also the first to introduce a full court pressure defense. Nobody had really seen that either in the way that he did. And the third thing is that college basketball training regimens in those days where basketball players would do a lot of jumping jacks and deep knee bends and maybe standing formation boxing. A typical pregame meal was a T-bone steak and a mashed potato and a piece of cherry pie or something like that. McClendon realized that if his players were going to play this super fast game, that they had to be the best in shape. And so 10, 15 years before jogging comes to the United States, he's having his players run out in the country for miles 3 days a week. He's having these grueling practices. And what happened is that there was nobody that could catch him. The refs would get winded. Other teams, you know, we have, you know, quotes from other players who said, "Coach, they're getting faster." So he's a huge part of this transformation of the game. And the book tails off with another transformation, which has to do with the introduction of an all-weather rubber basketball that coincides with demographic shifts. And what's going to happen is there's going to be lots of anonymous black players in the North and in the West in housing projects who are going to start to reinvent basketball on their own. And those two elements are going to help take basketball from what the old timers called slow, slower, and slowest into a fast and exciting and artistic game.
So basically this guy invented modern basketball.
Yes, he did.
So let's take a look at the other half. You said that there were people working in the South on this issue of desegregation. How does that relate to the secret game?
It relates to it in, there's a quick vignette. So there's a German-Jewish refugee couple who ends up in Durham, North Carolina. They get out of Europe by the skin of their teeth. Their lives were saved by the president of the black college who gave a job to the husband.
We're talking Second World War Nazi type.
Yeah. So, right, the war is just beginning. They start holding illicit interracial meetings in their homes until the Ku Klux Klan finds out and threatens to murder them. But there were also students at Duke and students at North Carolina College for Negroes, who, and we can leave the refugees out, who America's in a war. They think we should have a better world. So they start holding illicit prayer services together at night. And it was out of these prayer services that the idea for the game was created.
All right. So you got these students that are breaking the rules on starting to pray together. You got this refugee couple stimulating discussions. So how does that relate to a basketball game?
Well, it relates to the basketball game in that the students who are meeting together illicitly start talking about basketball. One set of students from Duke says, well, we got a pretty good team at Duke. The Duke Medical School basketball team had beaten the Duke varsity. There were a lot of terrific military teams during World War II. And McClendon's team, meanwhile, in 1943, 1944, was the highest scoring basketball team in the United States. But in 1943, 1944, the NCAA tournament and the NIT tournament did not allow black colleges to play.
Now, let's just say that again. NCAA national tournament and the NIT tournament did not allow black colleges to play.
They did not allow African Negro colleges, as they were called in those days, to play. So McClendon knew he had a breakthrough. He created this new way of playing basketball, but there was no way to test it on a national front.
Sure, and so like the black baseball leagues, they'd say, yeah, but they're just playing in the black league. It's not as tough as the white league, so it's 90 points isn't 90 points. They're playing against poorer competition.
Exactly.
Et cetera.
So one of the kids who had been at the prayer meeting approaches Coach McClendon and says, we've got this idea. And at first he was resistant for different reasons, and eventually he said, yes, let's go ahead and do it.
Okay, and what about the white coach?
There was no white coach. So these are all full-time medical students who are also enlisted in the United States Army and the United States Navy. They're in a hurry-up medical school program to create more doctors for the war effort. But they are all former college basketball stars. There were tons of military teams during World War II. Regular colleges no longer played regular schedules. They played against a lot of military teams as well, too. This was the great team at Duke. They were very good. The idea came to them, and a Montanan by the name of Jack Burgess, who had come to Durham to be a part of the medical school experience, who was somebody who was offended at segregation, said, let's go ahead and do this. And he turns out to be a key individual in getting the Southerners on the team to go ahead and play.
Now, presumably, everybody involved in the game knew the risk that is reflected in your story of the Army veteran who was murdered.
Right.
So this was not done lightly.
Not at all. And certainly for Coach McClendon, it was this. People, listeners today will find this unusual, but he once told me that back in the 1940s and before, black players and black coaches didn't know, in general, whether they could play as well as white players. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to find out. That was one reason. For the white players, it became ultimately a matter, the Southerners, it became a matter of pride. This young Montanan challenges them and says, are you guys chicken to play these guys? Do you think they're better than you are? And you have to remember in the South at that time, the memory of the Civil War and the loss of the Civil War is something that's part of Southern life. Southern honor is a big thing. And eventually one of the players, one of the best players on the team said, well, let's go and find out. So that's how this astonishing event got going.
Okay, so now where do they hold a basketball
game?
Well,
the only place they can hold it is in the gym at the black school. They hold it on a Sunday morning because that's when everyone, including the police force, the all-white police force in Durham, are in church. Hmm. They sneak over. They have a referee. They have a scorer, but there are no invited spectators. They have the game. They end up then sort of going it even further in a violation of segregation in that they then play a game of skins and shirts where they mix their two teams together as well.
The same day?
The same day.
All right. In addition to the score, something else happens, I'm inferring. Because before that game, I'm suspecting that Southern whites would not do a shirts skins game with African American people.
No, and what happens, there's a lot of tension early on in the game. There's a hard foul early on in the game that might turn into a fist fight. The referee comes and breaks it up, and what happens is they get lost in the world of basketball. You know, athletes are like musicians. When they're into what they're doing, they don't really care who the other person looks like. But it was a great risk that they all took, and there were repercussions that happened as well later on. But this book, I was very lucky that Coach McLennan approached me that day.
No
kidding. I was lucky that these other guys were alive and that we were able to save this story and that this is a story I'm proud to have been able to write about.
I just interviewed a former Liberian who's an American citizen who said that we don't talk as a race. This is 2015. And that we better start. What do you say about that?
I say that person is exactly right. I mean, I think our country in many ways is obsessed with race, and we think about it a lot, and we talk about it, but we only talk about it with people who look like us. That's our problem. Our churches are segregated. Our neighborhoods are largely segregated. Our school system in big cities is certainly largely segregated. We need to talk about it. We need to recognize the ills in our past, but we also need to remember that we've had a long heritage dating back to the Underground Railroad, dating back to slave revolts, the abolitionists, everyone, of Americans of all colors who have always worked together and take chances to give us a better heritage. The people that I discovered in The Secret Game are forgotten American heroes who took great risks, but they also helped to give us the world that we have today.
Scott Ellsworth, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.